Hello, and welcome to Science World. We're back with a fresh new show for you today. Astronomers have gotten the first ever peek at our solar system's tail. NASA's next Mars rover will be looking for signs of past life. And we'll hear how experiments with fire aboard the International Space Station are helping scientists develop more effective fire suppressants and get a better understanding of the combustion process. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. The heliosphere is the region of space that is influenced by the sun. Images from NASA's Interstellar Boundary Explorer spacecraft, known as IBEX, have allowed scientists to map out the heliosphere's tail for the first time. Suzanne Presto has more.
If you've ever seen a speeding comet, or even an image of one, you've seen that it has a tail. Scientists have thought that our solar system also has a tail, but they just observed it for the first time. Eric Christian, an IBEX mission scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, says scientists have seen tails around other stars.
We know that the sun is moving relative to interstellar gas, and so we presume there was a tail, but this is actually the first real data that we have that gives us the shape of the tail.
And that shape? Scientists say it's like a four-leaf clover, shaped by solar wind, that material that speeds away from the sun. Solar wind travels faster when it comes from the sun's poles, and slower when it comes from the equator. And scientists attribute the tail's shape to the combination of slow and fast-moving particles. David McComas is the IBEX principal investigator and assistant vice president for space science and engineering at the Southwest Research Institute in Texas.
So the length of the tail is one of the things that we don't measure particularly well. Because we make a line-of-sight integrated measurements from the inside looking out, they're not fundamentally easy to get the length.
McComas says scientists can make calculations based on the particles they observe, and they think the helio tail trails off and evaporates over a distance of possibly 160 billion kilometers. The findings about the solar system's tail were published in the July 10th issue of the Astrophysical Journal. NASA's IBEX spacecraft was launched in 2008, and the small satellite is roughly the size of a bus tire. It has instruments similar to telescopes that are pointed toward the edge of our solar system. These instruments collect particles that travel toward our planet from out beyond Pluto. Scientists analyze details about the particles' mass and energy, as well as the area they came from and the time they were collected, and they use these details to map the boundary of our solar system. Suzanne Presto, VOA News, Washington.
Swedish researchers have found that singers in a choir don't just unify their voices. As Megan McGrath reports, their pulse rates are also synchronized, and their hearts beat together, faster and slower, in relation to their breaths.
Right now, you're breathing and you're not even thinking about it. But when a group of people sing together, like the Kansas City Chorale, they are breathing in and out as a group, with the rhythm of their song.
When you sing, you do that on the air that you are exhaling, so that's a kind of guided breathing.
Bjorn Wyckoff is a singer-songwriter and a neuroscientist at Sweden's University of Gothenburg. He studies the effects of music on our bodies. His most recent research, published in the journal Frontiers in Neuroscience, found that when members of a choir sing and breathe together, their hearts speed up and slow down in unison.
As you are singing a phrase, your heart rate goes down. And then between the phrases, when you inhale, then the heart rate goes up.
Our hearts naturally speed up and slow down as we breathe, but Wyckoff explains that this is just one part of our physiology that syncs up when people sing together.
When you sing together, you're synchronizing just about everything, the melody, the text, the rhythm. You have to really adapt to each other. And that's a counterpoint in that in your body internally.
He says aspects of choir singers' nervous systems are also synchronized. Their moods may become aligned too, as the deep breathing involved in singing slow passages prompts a feeling of calm and relaxation. Group singing is cooperative, both physically and emotionally.
Singing together is creating bonds between people, and that's supported, I think, by the research that we just have done.
This may help explain why most world religions incorporate song into their worship, along with chanting mantras and prayers. They are communal rituals that involve both the mind and the body. Megan McGrath, VOA News, Washington.
This past Tuesday, a new bill was introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives that would create a new U.S. national park on the moon. Science World's Bob Doty tells us more.
The goal of the proposed legislation, called the Apollo Lunar Landing Legacy Act, would be to increase and enhance the preservation and protection of various historical artifacts left by NASA's Apollo Lunar Mission Program. The bill's sponsor, Congresswoman Donna Edwards of Maryland, wants to make sure that the Apollo program's landing and exploration sites are protected, as new commercial space companies and space programs from other nations are attaining the technical abilities that are necessary to land their spacecraft on the lunar surface. Congresswoman Edwards, in a speech introducing her proposed bill to the U.S. House of Representatives, said that the Apollo Lunar Landing Legacy Act will ensure that the scientific data and cultural significance of the Apollo artifacts remains unharmed by future lunar landings. By including them into a national historic park, the Congresswoman said that her bill would assert unquestioned ownership rights over the Apollo Lunar Landing artifacts. The bill would also require the U.S. Secretary of the Interior to pursue nominating the historic Apollo 11 lunar landing site, where man first stepped onto the moon's surface nearly 44 years ago, as a World Heritage Site.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
NASA sent and landed humans on the moon six times between July 1969 and December 1972. There was supposed to be a seventh mission to the moon's surface in April of 1970 with Apollo 13, but the mission's lunar landing had to be scrubbed because of a serious explosion aboard the spacecraft. Reporting for Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
Speaking of lunar landings, where on the moon did humans take their first steps? Was it A, the Ocean of Storms, B, the Sea of Tranquility, or C, the Valley of Taurus Latrobe? Do you think you have the right answer? Well, stick around. The correct answer is coming up for you in just a little bit.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Some fish farmers wonder if a vegetable-based feed could be a more cost-effective replacement for currently used feed that uses wild fish as a key ingredient, which keeps going up in price. But will the fish like the veggie food? And how will fish raised on that diet taste to consumers? Tom Bonsi reports.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome to the Trout Filet Taste Panel. Here's some water and crackers to rinse your palate.
Thanks. I'm one of 72 volunteers recruited as taste testers. We're at the School of Food Science at Washington State University in Pullman. I'm seated, fork at the ready, in a row of booths, kind of like voting booths, but with sliding windows to the test kitchen.
Okay, this is the first of three pairs of samples. Okay. So just push the switch when you're ready for your next sample and follow the instructions on your screen, okay?
Thank you. All right, so if it's true that you are what you eat, I should be able to tell the difference between these trout samples that I'm being presented, because one of them was raised on fish meal, another on animal proteins, and a third on a mostly vegetarian diet. I'm going to try sample A here. Pretty classic trout flavor there. These have been poached. There's no sauce on them. So you get pure, unadulterated trout. Couldn't really tell you if that was raised on fish, land animals, or vegetables. I compare notes later with some of my fellow testers. Some got a little bit of grassy flavor from what turned out to be the vegetarian-fed trout fillet. The trout raised on traditional fish meal had slightly more fishy flavor and aroma. The trout that ate chicken byproducts did not taste like chicken. The definition of success in this aquaculture experiment would be for the non-fish alternative diets to yield fillets that taste more or less the same as those raised on the current fish-based feed. The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization reports that farming of fish that eat pond plants or bottom feed, like carp, catfish, and tilapia, is expanding slower than production of carnivorous species, including salmon, rainbow trout, and tuna.
That makes the search for a cost-effective alternative to fish-based feed more urgent. It's the industry's number one priority, according to longtime Idaho fish farmer Leo Ray. Idaho is by far the number one trout-producing state in the United States. Ray says fish meal cost him about $300 per ton about 15 years ago. Nowadays, the same amount runs him close to $2,000. Ray says the suppliers he buys from have already reduced the wild fish content in commercial feeds somewhat. He and his competitors in southern Idaho have gladly tested all sorts of alternative diets. They've fed their fish poultry byproducts, corn and soybean protein, coconut oil, and ground up insect larvae, to name a few. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is working with fish farmers and university researchers on trout diets. The project's lead scientist says this goes beyond trout. It applies to other aquaculture species as well. Parallel studies are testing alternative feeds for farmed Atlantic salmon and several species of warm water fish. Separate studies by university researchers in Texas and Alabama have investigated plant-based diets for farmed shrimp. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Pullman, Washington.
The World Health Organization reports tobacco control measures can avert millions of deaths. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The World Health Organization estimates some 3 billion people globally now are covered by at least one life-saving measure to limit tobacco use. In 2008, WHO identified 6 tobacco control measures that are the most effective in reducing tobacco use. In this year's report on the global tobacco epidemic, WHO focuses on bans on tobacco advertising, promotion, and sponsorship, which it considers one of the most powerful measures to control tobacco use. It says the number of people covered by these bans has increased by almost 400 million people, living mainly in low- and middle-income countries. The director of WHO's Prevention of Non-Communicable Diseases Department, Douglas Betcher, says this shows the tobacco industry's bullying tactics are not working as well as before.
Doors, thank goodness, are closing on the industry. So it means that their bottom line is to sell. Their bottom line is to get more people hooked and younger people hooked, and they'll kill more people. I mean, that's their bottom line. And the industry, being underhanded, will stop at nothing to get their messages out. So it's important that that countries ban all forms of advertising, promotion, sponsorship.
As of today, WHO says 24 countries with 694 million people have introduced complete bans, and 100 more countries are close to a complete ban. However, it notes 67 countries do not ban tobacco advertising, promotion, and sponsorship activities. WHO reports tobacco is the leading preventable cause of death worldwide. It says it kills 6 million people every year, more than tuberculosis, HIV, and malaria combined. It says tobacco can cause cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and chronic respiratory diseases. If current trends continue, WHO warns the number of smoking-related deaths will rise to 8 million a year by 2030. Betcher says studies show that WHO's 6 evidence-based tobacco control measures, known as M-Power, are the most effective in reducing tobacco use. Betcher says 41 countries have adopted at least one of the 6 M-Power measures as of 2010. He says an estimated 7.4 million lives have been saved during these 3 years in those countries that have adopted and implemented one of those measures at the highest level. Case studies show countries including Panama, China, Thailand, Madagascar, Australia, Uruguay, Ghana, and Turkey are succeeding in cutting tobacco use. WHO says it does not take money for countries to get their populations to quit this deadly habit. It takes political will. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Even as its Curiosity rover makes tracks on Mars, NASA is thinking ahead to the next rover it plans to send to the Red Planet. Suzanne Presto joins us again to tell us about the Mars 2020 Science Definition Team's concept for future Mars exploration.
A NASA-appointed team of 19 scientists and engineers says the next Mars rover should seek out signs of past life on the Red Planet and collect samples for a possible future return to Earth. One member of the Mars 2020 Science Definition Team, Lindy Elkins Tanton of the Carnegie Institution in Washington, studies the evolution of planets. She told reporters during a NASA teleconference that questions are what drive scientific discoveries.
One of the very biggest questions for all of humankind is, are we alone? And that is the question we're hoping to make really big advances with this Mars 2020 mission.
Scientists already scored a major victory when the Curiosity rover, which landed on the red planet last August, provided evidence that ancient Mars had an environment that could have supported living microbes. The team says the next step is to actually seek out biosignatures, preserved features in ancient rocks and soil that could have formed biologically. Jack Mustard is the chair of the science definition team and a professor of geological sciences at Brown University in Rhode Island. He says team members did discuss whether to look for existing life on Mars.
But the feeling was, on the basis of the scientific evidence we have today, that the most logical steps forward were to look for the ancient signs of life that were being preserved within the rock record.
He emphasized that evidence suggests habitable environments on Mars were common in the ancient past. The next rover will look similar to the car-sized, six-wheeled Curiosity rover, in part because using an existing design will reduce costs. The 2020 rover would be able to drill into and sample Martian rock, just as Curiosity does now. But the team says a major objective for the next rover is to package as many as 31 samples that could be returned to Earth during a later mission. John Grunsfeld, a former astronaut and NASA's Associate Administrator for Science in Washington, noted that while the 2020 rover mission concept allows for the selection, gathering, and caching of samples, it does not include their eventual return.
You know, I wouldn't rule out that perhaps human explorers will go and retrieve the cache, you know, in 20-plus years from now as explorers set foot on Mars. You know, that's an eventual goal, is to put astrobiologists and planetary scientists on the surface of Mars.
The team also says the 2020 rover should help advance NASA's plans for human exploration of the red planet in the 2030s. The 2020 mission could help scientists understand any hazards posed by Martian dust, or demonstrate ways to collect carbon dioxide that could be used as a resource for making oxygen or rocket fuel. The Mars 2020 Science Definition Team released its 154-page report on Tuesday. Suzanne Presto, VOA News, Washington.
Okay, let's see if you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz. Today, we wanted to know, where on the moon did humans take their first steps? Was it A, the Ocean of Storms, B, the Sea of Tranquility, or C, the Valley of Taurus Latrobe? The answer is B. Apollo 11 astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Buzz Aldrin were the first humans to step onto the moon's surface after landing their Lunar Excursion Module, or LEM, in the Sea of Tranquility on July 21, 1969. By the way, answer C, the Valley of Taurus Latrobe, is where crew members from the Apollo 17 landed. It's the last place on the moon where humans have walked. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Can you imagine lighting a fire aboard the International Space Station? Well, that's what crew members have been doing ever since 2009 in conducting a series of experiments for NASA called the Flame Extinguishment Experiment, or FLEX. FLEX researchers have been performing these experiments mostly in the name of safety. The main purpose of the experiment is to evaluate just how effective various fire suppressants perform in microgravity. But they've also been trying to get a better understanding of how fuels burn when there's very little gravity to contend with. Dr. Foreman Williams, a professor at the University of California, San Diego, is the project's principal researcher and has been working on fire research and fire safety with NASA since the 1970s. Professor Williams joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about the FLEX experiments, what they've learned so far, and what flames and combustion are like in outer space. Why is the space agency so interested in knowing more about this?
Well, it's important for a number of reasons, both scientific and practical. They're concerned with the two main areas would be fire safety and improved efficiency or reducing pollution and combustion processes for power production and things like that.
The project you're involved with is called Fundamental Studies in Droplet Combustion and Flame Extinguishment in Microgravity 2, or FLEX 2. Can you tell us a little bit about this project?
We're burning single fuel droplets of different fuels in the International Space Station now to get better understanding of the chemistry and physics of how fuel droplets burn.
I understand that you got quite a surprise lately during a recent experiment aboard the International Space Station in using heptane fuel, something that's being called cool flames. Can you tell us about this and what you discovered?
We were very surprised. We never expected to see quasi-study fuel droplet burning supported by cool flames. It's always in the past we found it supported by hot flames. And what we observed is that the hot flame extinguished, but it seemed that the droplet still burnt. At least it still kept decreasing in size. With the instrumentation we had, we could not even see a flame. But we did see later studies some radiant energy output. The results then are consistent with cool flame being steadily supporting the droplet combustion process, which was totally unexpected. The cool flames that we did not expect to find in space turn out to be relevant to attempts to improve efficiencies and reduce pollution in IC engines, homogeneous charge compression ignition engines. On Earth, they tend to burn under conditions in which cool flame chemistry is relevant, and we don't understand the cool flame chemistry that well. And so these experiments in ISS may help us to better understand the cool flame chemistry that could lead to these improved performance of the future automobile engines that we'll be driving around on the highways, hopefully.
When we're talking about cool flame, what is the difference between a hot flame and a cool flame?
Hot flame burns to the equilibrium combustion products that we normally expect. Carbon dioxide and water vapor are the main products of hydrocarbon combustion, whereas the cool flame is an entirely different chemical process, and the products are quite different. The products are things like formaldehyde, carbon monoxide, ethylene. These are intermediates in ordinary combustion processes, but they turn out to be the final products in the cool flame process. And because of that, the temperatures are, instead of being around 2,000 degrees Kelvin, they're instead around 500 to 1,000 or less than 1,000 degrees Kelvin for the flame temperatures. And that's why there's relatively little radiant energy output. It's harder to see these flames because they're so cold. In a combustion sense, they're cold or cool.
I'm assuming that when you want to study flames in combustion, you must consider the fuel sources that feed the flames, such as either wood-based products or petroleum. What is FLEX2 studying specifically?
It's only liquid fuel droplets. There are similarities between combustion of certain liquid fuels and solid fuels as well. But the two main fuels that have been studied in FLEX, the initial FLEX, are methanol and heptane. But in FLEX 2, we're looking at a number of other fuels as well. In particular, we're looking at constituents of model fuels. Real fuels are mixtures of large number of different fuel species. And to get better understanding of how these mixtures burn, so-called surrogate fuels have been studied now recently, which are mixtures of a small number, like two or three or four different species. And so we've been studying the individual components of surrogate fuels, how they burn, what their flammability would be in these ISS experiments in FLEX 2.
That was Dr. Foreman Williams from the University of California, San Diego. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.